Let us turn again in our Bibles to the book of Daniel and chapter 2. Like many people of my generation, there were some things that we were told as children that were simply not true. And so, for example, we were told that if we ate vegetables, it would help us to see in the dark. I don't know if those of you with young children continue to tell your children that sort of thing. Another one we were told was that if we ate cheese late at night, then you are more likely to dream. But what I've discovered in reality is that whether I eat cheese or not, I still dream. And if you're one of those people who do tend to dream at night, then you'll know what it is to wake up and to be so relieved to find out that it was only a dream. I've lost count of the number of times I've dreamt that as I'm travelling to a preaching engagement, I get caught up in a traffic jam, and in my dream I can see the minutes of the clock rapidly ticking away as the time for the service rapidly approaches. Needless to say, I end up being late. But then it's not too bad, because as they're still singing the third hymn, when I arrive. And so I've just got enough time to slip into the pulpit and time to preach the sermon. But when I do eventually get there, I discover I've left my sermon notes at home. And so it's a preacher's worst nightmare. And that's why it's such a relief to wake up and discover it was all just a dream. Whew. What a relief. I can now go back to sleep. But if your name's Nebuchadnezzar, then you can't get back to sleep. And the reason he couldn't was because his dream was not merely the result of eating too much cheese. Instead, the reason he dreamt that night was because God wanted to teach him a lesson through his dream. And the reason his dream is recorded for us in the pages of our Bibles this morning is because thousands of years later, God wants to teach you and I the very same lessons. Now, please note, the way in which God teaches us those lessons today is not through us having dreams, but through the biblical record of Nebuchadnezzar's dream those many years ago. And the first thing we see in this frightening experience of King Nebuchadnezzar, the first thing we see is a contrast. We'll see two contrasts this morning. The first is in verses 1 to 30. And there we see a contrast between the true God and the false gods. A contrast between the true God and the false gods. Now, if you're familiar with the story of the of Daniel, then you'll know that the book of Daniel, it begins with a record of Nebuchadnezzar's military success. Having become the most powerful man on the planet, the king of Babylon looked for ways in which he could expand his empire. And in the year 605 BC, he turned his attention to the little kingdom of Judah, and he invaded it. The opening verses of chapter 1 tell us that he ransacked the place and he took its most valuable treasures back to Babylon. Later on in chapter 1, we discover that he also took Judah's most talented people back to Babylon as well. And having known such great success as he knew, you may be thinking to yourself this morning, what on earth was there for this guy to worry about? He's got everything going for him in life, has he not? He's got power and possessions and popularity galore. Everything he turns his hand to as an emperor seems to succeed. If ever there was someone who didn't need to have a sleepless night, surely it was him. But in the opening verses of chapter 2, we read these words: in the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled, and he could not sleep. And so what did he do? Well, don't forget, this is the king of Babylon, and as such, he has a huge palace staff that he can turn to for help. He has employed people for every eventuality in life. You sometimes hear reports of that, don't you know? Some of those, some dictator in some parts of the world. I remember hearing that Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il, there was a time when he had eight hairdressers, eight personal hairdressers. And you think, why on earth can someone ever employ eight hairdressers? What are they all doing all the time? Well, it was a little bit like that for Nebuchadnezzar. He had employed loads of people for every eventuality. And amongst the staff, there were some magicians, and there were some enchanters, and there were sorcerers, and there were astrologers. People who were supposed to be qualified in reading the stars and interpreting dreams and all that sort of typical pagan Babylonian stuff. And so he sends for them to see if they can help him on this occasion. O king, live forever, we hear them saying in verse 4. Tell your servants the dream, and we will interpret it. Tell us the dream, and we will interpret it. That's how these guys normally went about their day's work. Someone told them a dream, and they made up what sounded like a plausible explanation to it. That's how they survived. That's how they made their living. But that strategy is not going to work this time. It's not going to work this time for the simple reason, as Nebuchadnezzar says in verse 5, if you do not tell me what my dream was and interpret it, I will have you cut into pieces and your houses turned into piles of rubble. But if you do tell me the dream and explain it, you'll receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Have you ever heard of performance-related pay? Well, this was performance-related pay on a grand scale. Do a good job and the world was your oyster. Do a bad job and you were reduced to the size of an oyster. Literally. And the reason why the stakes have been raised so high is because Nebuchadnezzar senses that there is a lot at stake here. And if these employees of his have the supernatural ability to tell him what his dream means, then you would have thought that they would have had the supernatural ability to tell him what the dream was in the first place, would you not? He's not stupid, Nebuchadnezzar. But they can't. They can't. And that's why we hear them saying in verse 10, there's not a man on earth who can do what the king asks. Not a man on earth. Verse 11, what the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods. And they do not live among men. That's the problem with false man-made pagan religion. It worships gods which cannot communicate with us and therefore cannot reveal to us the solutions to our greatest problems in life. And please don't think that such a religion was restricted to the ancient Babylonian Empire. It's rife throughout the Western world. And it's rife here in our part of the world. Several weeks ago, I bumped into an elderly gentleman in Bangor, a man that I've known for many years. He's a very pleasant man, a more pleasant man you'd be struggling to find. And he used to be a keen mountain runner. But now that he's in his late 80s, he's given that up. Please note, he's given it up in his late 80s, so there's no excuse for most of us here this morning. But he misses the mountains, he told me. He misses the mountains. Because, he said, it's when you're at the top of a mountain like Snowdon that you sense that you are in touch with reality. Sounds impressive, doesn't it? Until you think about it. I took the opportunity to say that the Bible teaches us that the creation around us is a testimony to the existence of an eternal and infinitely powerful God. But he wasn't interested in that, because for him the creation or Mother Earth, as he called it, is his God. He always referred to Snowdon as Eirwydfa, which is the Welsh name for Snowdon, but he referred to it as Eirwydfa not because he is first language Welsh speaking, because that is the name by which he prefers to refer to his deity. And it was when he was on the top of Eirwydfa in the past that he sensed that he was in the presence of and in touch with the supernatural. That is the religion of ancient Babylon. And it's rife here, and well, it's rife for us in North Wales. And I suspect you probably have your fair share of it here in Manchester. And if that happens to be your religion this morning, then listen to the testimony of these astrologers from Babylon in verse 11. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among men. The pagan gods of Babylon cannot provide an answer to the king's urgent and greatest question. They can't. And many years later, the pagan gods of our country, they cannot provide an answer to our biggest and our most pressing and our most urgent questions in life. Questions such as, who are we? Where have we come from? Why are we here? And especially, where are we going after this? If we are going to find an answer to those big questions in life, if we're going to find an answer to those big questions, then we'll need much more than a feeling or a sensation on the top of Snowdon. If we are going to find an answer to those big questions, then we will need a God who can communicate with us and who can reveal such truth to us. And that is precisely the type of God that Daniel had. Having heard about the death sentence which Nebuchadnezzar had passed and all the wise men of Babylon, including Daniel and his friends, Daniel asked to speak to the king. He asked for time, verse 16, so that he might be able to interpret the dream for him. Then he and his three friends prayed, verse 18. They plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that they might not be executed with the rest of the wise men in Babylon. And we are told in verse 19, during the night this mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. And if you are in any doubts as to where this revelation has come from, then just listen to Daniel's response in verses 20 to 23. He says, praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his. He changes times and season. He sets up kings and deposes them. Please note, this is the God who is in control of both nature and world history. And yet, although being extremely powerful, he's not distant or remote, with the result that he's unable to be involved in the lives of men and women. Far from it, verse 21. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what lies in darkness. In other words, there is nothing that he does not know and does not understand. And although he does not reveal everything, he does reveal those things which his people need to know, which in the case of Daniel was, end of verse 23, you have made known to us the dream of the king. And consequently, Daniel is able to go to Nebuchadnezzar and say to him, verse 27, no wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he has asked about. But listen to this. There is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. There is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. Do you see the difference between the pagan gods of Babylon and the God of Daniel? Do you see the difference? Whereas they were unable to communicate, they were unable to reveal anything. They're unable to help. They're unable to intervene in nature or world history. They're unable to come to the rescue of their people. They're unable to respond to the desperate plea of their people. They're unable to help their worshippers in their most desperate times. Although they're unable to do all of that, Daniel's God was able to do all of those things. He is the sovereign God, as you see in chapter 1, and he is the revealing God, as we see here in chapter 2. And the revealing God that Daniel needed and knew back then is the very same God that you and I desperately need today. Desperately. You see, rather than having a God who's supposedly present on those few rare occasions when we're standing at one of the world's beauty spots, rather than having a God like that, we need a God who's every bit as real and every bit as present, regardless of where we are or what we are doing, whether we are on the top of Mount Snowdon with his great view, or whether we are walking through the streets of central Manchester. We need a God who's every bit as real and every bit as present, regardless of where we are and what we are doing. And rather than having a God who supposedly provides a subjective sense of peace on a few rare occasions in life, we need a God who reveals the objective truth of how rebellious sinners like you and I can be brought into a permanent state of peace with a holy and eternal God like him. That's the kind of God we need. And did you know that is precisely the God of Daniel? That's precisely what the God of Daniel has done. And rather than leaving us in the dark, and rather than leave us in some subjective fog, the eternal God has revealed to us his truth. He has done what the pagan gods of Babylon and the pagan gods of Britain cannot do. And that is, he has spoken. That's the difference. Our God has spoken. He has given us his word. And in giving us his word, he has answered our biggest questions. And he has met our greatest needs. Our greatest needs as men and women and young people is to get right with the God who created us and the God that we are answerable to. That's our greatest need. To quote the words of someone from long ago, our biggest and most pressing question is, how can a man be righteous before God? That's it. How can a man be righteous before God? And the great news this morning is that the true and living God has answered that question for us. In the good news that he has revealed to us concerning his Son. Do you remember what the Apostle Paul says in Romans chapter 1 and in verse 16? He says he's not ashamed of the gospel. He has every confidence in the gospel. And why does he have every confidence in the gospel? He says because it's the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes. And why is the gospel contained such power? He says because in the gospel, it's in the biblical gospel, says Paul in Romans 1 verse 17. It's in the good news about Jesus Christ that a righteousness from God is revealed. A righteousness that is by faith from first to last. Do you see the difference between the pagan gods of this world and the true God of heaven? The pagan gods of Babylon could do nothing for those men as the time of their death rapidly approached. Nothing. And likewise, the pagan gods of our country can do nothing for you, especially when you're no longer fit enough to trail to their beauty spots. Whereas in sharp contrast, the true God of heaven has spoken. And in doing so, he has revealed to us all that we need to know concerning this life. And more importantly, concerning the life to come. He has revealed how we can have our sins forgiven. He has revealed how we can come to know him on a righteous basis, and therefore how we can be prepared to meet him on a future day. He has told us in no uncertain terms that it is through trusting in the sacrificial death of his Son, Jesus Christ, upon the cross, that we can be at peace with God. And we can know his peace from day to day. Oh yes, the God of heaven is a revealing God who reveals the truth that we desperately need to know. That is the contrast. Contrast between the true God and all the false gods that we have around us. But that's not the only contrast in Daniel chapter 2. There is another contrast, and that's in verses 31 to 49. And there we see a contrast between a permanent kingdom and passing kingdoms. A contrast between a permanent kingdom and passing kingdoms. Having had the king's dream and its interpretation revealed to him by God, Daniel begins in verse 31 by telling Nebuchadnezzar what he saw. He says, "You looked, O king, and there before you stood a large statue," a large image, it says in the ESV, "an enormous, dazzling image, awesome in appearance. The head of the statue was made of pure gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, and its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron, partly of baked clay." I'm sure you can picture it. Huge statue. And as you work your way from the head down to the feet, you go from pure gold to silver to bronze to iron and then to a mixture of iron and clay. You can picture it, but if you want to know what it stood for, then just look at the close of verse 38. Speaking to Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel says this. He says, "You are that head of gold." You are that head of gold. Can you imagine? Can you imagine how Nebuchadnezzar must have felt when he heard that? Not only is he the head of the statue, but he is a head made of gold. His ego probably started to expand at a phenomenal rate. Until, that is, he heard the words of verse 39. "After you, another kingdom will rise, inferior to yours." Oh, it may be inferior, but it's going to be a different kingdom. Which indicates that no matter how great and powerful and dominant the Babylonian kingdom may be, it won't last forever. This statute indicates that there's a day coming when it will be conquered by another kingdom. And by the time you get to chapter 5 of this book, you discover that it would be the Medo-Persian Empire that would replace it. And however great that empire would be, it too would have a limited lifespan, and that it would eventually be overtaken by the Greek Empire, which in turn would be replaced by the Roman Empire. And so the statue what Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream is a statue which represents four consecutive passing kingdoms in the history of our world. Well, at the time Nebuchadnezzar had his dream, his empire was at its greatest, and therefore it would have seemed invincible. If you had been a political commentator at that time, looking on for a distance, if you had been asked to go on Newsnight and asked, "What do you think of Babylon at this present moment in time?" you would have said, "Ha, this is it. This is it now. It really has arrived. This is the empire that's here to stay." That's how it looked. That's how it seemed. But it wasn't. Oh yes, it had its glory days. And then it dropped off the stage of world history. And what happened to it happened also to the next three great empires. And what happened to them has happened to every great empire since then. They have risen to great power and prominence only to fade away. You don't need to have a great knowledge of history to know that. It happened, for example, to the Mongol Empire of the 14th century. It happened to the Austro-Hungarian Empire of the 19th century. It happened, dare I say it, to the British Empire. It happened to the Soviet Empire of the 20th century. It is a recurrent pattern in the history of our world. A recurrent pattern. It's a recurrent pattern which ought to have taught Nebuchadnezzar an important lesson back then, and it ought to teach you and I an important lesson today, and that is, don't put too much confidence in the kingdoms of this world. Don't. Without wanting to be too pessimistic, and contrary to what all our politicians are telling us week by week, the Britain that we love may never be the great Britain that we long for ever again. And please note, that is not meant to be a political statement. That is simply a lesson that we need to learn from Nebuchadnezzar's dream in Daniel chapter 2. Kingdoms and empires, they have their great days, and then they fade away. But thankfully, it's not the only lesson to be learned, because Nebuchadnezzar saw something else in the dream. And that was verse 34. A rock was cut out, but not by human hands. It struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and smashed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze and the silver and the gold were broken to pieces at the same time and became like chaff on a threshing floor in summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace. But the rock that struck the statue, it became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth. And if you want to know the significance of that rock, then just look at verse 44. In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. Please note, this kingdom is different from all the other kingdoms that have just been described. Although it is God who ultimately raises up all the kingdoms of this world, this one is established by God in a particular way. Verse 45 describes the rock as being cut out of a mountain, but not by human hands. In other words, this kingdom has supernatural origins and it's supernatural in character. That is why it's ultimately able to overpower and overwhelm all the other kingdoms of the world. Did you notice that? It's not only the fourth empire that's reduced to rubble as a result of this rock. The entire statute is reduced to rubble. It indicates that while the kingdoms of this world are crumbling and collapsing all around us, there is a kingdom that is bucking the trend of history, and it's constantly growing, continually growing, and it will continue to grow until it becomes the only kingdom of this world. Unlike all the others that have come and gone during the course of world history, there is a kingdom that is lasting. There is a kingdom that is permanent. Doesn't that sound like the sort of kingdom that you would like to belong to this morning? Doesn't that sound like the sort of kingdom in which you would like to invest your hopes and your aspirations and your confidence? Doesn't that sound like the sort of kingdom that you would like to look to for your ultimate safety and security? A kingdom that is going to be around forever. There'll be no referendum on that kingdom. It's going to be here to stay forever. Well, the great news this morning is that while all the other kingdoms of this world are closing their doors and tightening their borders, this is a kingdom that gladly welcomes people like you and me, regardless of our nationality, regardless of our social status, regardless of our academic qualifications. It's not an Australian point system to get into this kingdom. And just as well, because do you know why? We would all be on 0 points. That's why. If it was a point system, we would all be on 0 points. Instead, this is a kingdom that is open to all who recognize that they are on 0 points, but who turn to the king of this kingdom and put their confidence in him to meet all their entrance requirements for them. Isn't that great news? Somebody else can meet our entrance requirements for us. And just as well, because we don't have a point to our name. And just in case our politicians have confused you as to who you should really be putting your confidence in these days, let me tell you who this king is and what this kingdom is. Did you notice verse 44 that it was in the time of those kings that this kingdom appears on the stage of world history? Did you notice that? And what kings is it referring to? Well, Daniel has just been describing the fourth of the four empires. He's just been describing the Roman Empire, and according to this vision, it's during the time of that empire's supremacy that this other kingdom is established by God. Do you know what happened during the glory days of the Roman Empire? A man appeared on the stage of world history, and this was his message. The time has come. The kingdom of God is near. repent and believe the good news. That man was Jesus, the King through whom God was establishing his kingdom on this earth. And through trusting in him and in him alone this morning, you and I can know him as our King. And you and I can have the enormous privilege of belonging to his kingdom, a kingdom which is permanent rather than passing. And for those of us who already do belong to God's kingdom, for those of us who have already bowed the knee and submitted to Jesus Christ as our King, we must never forget. We must never forget that the book of Daniel was originally written to encourage God's people in difficult, dangerous times. It was written to encourage God's people when they were living in a pagan environment. And the message of Daniel chapter 2 for them and for us many years later is that however badly the kingdoms of this world may treat us, and if you've got any doubts as to how badly they can sometimes treat us, then just read on into chapter 3 and you'll see. And just read some of reports from brothers and sisters around the world today, and you'll see just how badly the kingdoms of this world can treat us as the people of God. But the great message of Daniel chapter 2 is that however badly they may treat us, their power and their influence is passing. Their power and their influence is fading. Their power and their influence is temporary. Whereas in sharp contrast to them, our King and his kingdom is permanent. Permanent. During the 4th century AD, there was a Roman emperor called Julian. And of all the emperors Rome had, Julian was supposedly one of those who was particularly opposed to the followers of Jesus Christ. And on one occasion, while he and his men were trying to eradicate the Christian church from his empire, a soldier of his who was on the rampage looking for Christians came across a Christian and asked this Christian what he thought was a mocking and humiliating question. He said to this Christian cynically, he said, "What's the carpenter's son doing these days?" To imply he's not doing very much, is he? Or we wouldn't be on the power. "What's the carpenter's son doing these days?" And then reply, the Christian said this. He says, "The maker of this world, whom you call the carpenter's son, the maker of this world is currently employed in making a coffin for the emperor." And within days, it was reported throughout the empire that their great emperor had died. That is what Daniel chapter 2 is all about. It teaches us that while the kings and kingdoms of this world, oh yes, some of them look as if they're here to stay, some of them look very powerful, but Daniel chapter 2 teaches us that the kings and kingdoms of this world will fade away and they'll pass away, and consequently they'll disappoint those who put their confidence in them. But in sharp contrast to them, there is a king and a kingdom which is here to last and therefore will never disappoint. Never. And so that being the case, can I plead with you this morning? Make sure this morning that you're trusting in this King. And make sure that you belong to his kingdom. If you are building your hopes on any other kingdom, and if you're putting your hopes in any other king or leader or whatever, let me tell you, sooner or later they will disappoint you. Oh, they may have their great days, but they'll eventually fade and pass away. rather than put your hopes and your confidence in them, you want to make sure you're small and that your hopes and your confidence and your trust and your faith is in a king and a kingdom that will last and last forever. Two great contrasts in Daniel chapter 2. The first is a contrast between the true God and the false gods. The second is a contrast between a permanent kingdom and some passing kingdoms. We are going to sing in closing hymn number 304. Hymn number 304, and it's a hymn that reminds us of the supremacy of Jesus Christ and how that there is coming a day when at the name of Jesus every knee shall bow and every tongue confess, King of glory now. 'Tis the Father's pleasure we should call him Lord, who from the beginning was the mighty Word. Verse 4 reads, in your hearts enthrone him, there let him subdue all that is not holy, all that is not true. Crown him as your captain. In temptation's hour, let his will enfold you in its light and power. Hymn number 304.